Moncrief on News Talk. From the heinous to the ridiculous. This is Moncrief's Murder Club.
You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. 087 1400 106 is our WhatsApp number. Cassie Delaney is with us once again for the Murder Club. And today we're talking about, these are very unsettling. I find them unsettling that people would do these things. We're going to be talking about crimes that came out of some very strange belief systems. Afternoon, Cassie.
Afternoon. So as we were saying there off mic, for reasons I won't get into on national radio, cult stories are very close to my heart. So I'm always fascinated.
you know what now? That poor Quive in there will be having nothing but texts in front of her saying, go on, tell us.
You can find me, DM me. That'll be released for a fee someday. But cult stories are fascinating because, as you just said there as we were chatting, we think we're very logical people and we have belief systems and we know what's real and what's not. But like with cult stories, they just seem to escalate very, very quickly, often to heinous levels.
And what's interesting about the first one is that you kind of automatically think, well, you know, Americans, but these were Swiss people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of American cults. There's an awful lot of like a rural farmland in Ohio that falls victim to cults. But this first story we're going to take you into in Switzerland. We're in October 1994. So again, not that long ago. And firefighters are called to a large house fire. And generally they would go in, put out the fire and then check formally for any deceased. And in this particular fire, they find 23 bodies. They're arranged in a circle in a room that has been decorated like a private chapel, mirrors on the walls, red velvet drapery and an altar. Several of the deceased are wearing robes. Some have gunshot wounds and others show no obvious injury at all. But it takes investigators weeks to figure out who are victims and who are the murderers and who've been shot and who died in the fire, who've been drugged first and who simply lay down and waited for the fire to take over. But on the same night, in a chalet 3 hours away in the village of Salvan, a second fire, this time 25 more bodies. So by the time they've finished even counting the victims here, they've also connected it to a third scene, which is slightly different. 5 days earlier, a house near Montreal, a mother, a father and their three-month-old son had been found stabbed to death. Initially, police thought this was a domestic tragedy, but it became apparent very quickly that it was connected to these mass deaths. The group responsible for it called itself the Order of the Solar Temple. And I think anytime you join a group of people called something of the temple, it's your first red flag. But they had existed for about a decade. They looked from the outside like a kind of conventional New Age society. These sort of lectures on ancient wisdom, weekend retreats, ceremonies, borrowing sort of aesthetics from medieval Knights of Templar. This, so far, this sounds appealing to me. Mm. Like a little weekend retreat and getaway from the city, I'm in, right? But its members were interesting people that you'd not expect to fall victim to something like this. They were doctors, a mayor, an official of Quebec's financial ministry, a ski instructor and a homeopath man named Luc Jourette, who gave lectures on alternative medicines that were so successful and so persuasive that people were driving hours to hear them. So behind this group sat the actual leader, the actual architect was Joseph de Mambro. He was a French jeweler with a string of failed businesses behind him. And by every account, kind of a jack of all trades, but someone whose gift was making people feel special and making very, very persuasive, you know, chatty catty, the kind of guy that I'd say would hold court at a party. And his core teachings was that the earth was about to approach a catastrophe and that only a select few would survive it. Not contrary by staying alive, but instead by choosing to take themselves out earlier, kind of on their own schedule. And he called this moment the transit. So he was careful to specify that this was in no way a harmful sort of mass suicide, but more a group choice to transition correctly and travel the spirit into the stars and become new solar bodies to live out in the coming age.
Okay, it was Sirius specifically that they were heading to, that star.
Yeah, so like a little bit airy-fairy, but what do we really know about astrology anyway? So, I mean, if someone's very, very persuasive telling all these things as fact, I don't know. So this might have stayed harmless, but there was this kind of detail in de Mambro's teachings and his whole plan for this group that became really, he just became a bee in his bonnet. And that was that his daughter, Emmanuel, was a kind of messiah in training. So he was really priming her to take over and be this gift to the world, almost a prophet-esque person. But by the time she was 12, she wanted nothing to do with it. She wanted to listen to pop music. She wanted to be, you know, hanging out with her pals. She wanted to live in ordinary teenage years. So she really turned her back on it. And that was going against his plan. At the same time, there was a couple in the group called Antonio and Nikki Dutois who had a son of their own, and they named him Christopher Emmanuel. So DeMambro took this as a slight on his plan, and he had explicitly forbidden them from having a child to begin with. And then when they used the name Emmanuel in the name of the child, he decided that this boy must be the Antichrist and that he was delivered specifically to mock his daughter's destiny. So in the last weeks of the group's existence, he had become fixated on this family and sent three members to their home, stabbed the father, stabbed the mother, and killed the son. The son in particular, very graphically, died with a wooden stake, which they felt was a kind of, rather than murder, was an act of purification. So the fires came a few days after that. Both DeMambro and Jurette died in them, along with everyone who might have ever explained why they had chosen to do this. The only person who was held accountable in any way was a Swiss composer named Michael Tabank, who had lectured for the group and co-written some of its ceremonies. He was acquitted twice, but basically anyone else who would have known what had happened to these 74 deaths in total had just taken themselves out in the process. So a transition and a plan, it was very successful in that there was nobody left behind.
Yeah. That's extraordinary.
Horrendous.
It does beg the question why the one person they tried to prosecute about it didn't get on board with the transit.
A lot of cults will have their defectors, and that's usually the thing that undermines them and gets them caught in the end. But this one, they stayed loyal to the end. I think because the composer didn't have that much involvement. Yeah. Like a light touch cult member.
Yeah.
A flaky one in the group, you know?
Flaky one. It's extraordinary though, really. Right. We're now going to go to
Ohio. This is familiar.
The kind of cult zero, cult ground zero, so to speak.
This is it. I mean, and this is a spin-off as well from the Mormon temple, the Mormon church. So I don't know if much you know about Mormonism. Very funny story. Joseph Smith built the first Mormon temple there in the 1830s, basically by finding a load of writings and saying that he was going to be the leader, and people got behind him. So before the church had split and moved west without him, Kirkland still had a temple. This is where we are in Ohio. And it had a small resident congregation of the reorganized Church of the Latter-day Saints. So for a while, a tour guide named Jeffrey Lundgren, who was the kind of de facto leader who'd stepped in when everybody else had separated and decided to move on. He was dismissed from the church in 1987. A common theme that we'll see in cult stories is someone who gets involved in organized religion and then detracts in some way and then starts something on their own with a small group of followers, and it just escalates. So he had been dismissed over accusations of embezzlement, but it didn't slow him down at all. And he decided he no longer needed the church's authority because he had his own teachings delivered, as he said, directly from God through a technique of scriptural reading he had essentially invented himself, and that he would hunt out for basically hidden patterns in text, pull out new teachings and learnings. And he managed to gain a following. Around 20 people followed him into a rented farmhouse outside of the original settlement. They signed over their paychecks. They were forbidden from speaking to one another without him present. And this was a rule that he justified by making everyone believe that he could read their minds. He told them the second coming would occur at the Kirkland Temple itself on his own birthday, and that they had to be ready. So the group's plan was that they were going to seize control of the original temple by force. He called the surrounding land around where they had lived the vineyard, and it all required a cleansing. But amongst his followers was a family called the Averys, Dennis and Cheryl, and three of their daughters, Trina, Rebecca and Karen. And they had sold, as members of this congregation were expected to, where they would sell their worldly possessions and hand over all their money to Lundgren. This family sold their home in Missouri to join them. But unlike the rest of the group, they didn't want to live in the big shared barn. I mean, who would choose to live in the big shared barn?
Yeah.
So they wanted to hold on to a private dwelling, and they withheld some of their money as well. Now, Lundgren found this absolutely unforgivable and again became a fixation of him. It is essentially, it's believed that he allowed the Averys to join in the first place so he could have access to their money. They were quite wealthy. And in the early 1989, Dennis Avery had started asking questions that Lundgren didn't really want to answer and just really sort of undermining or questioning his authority. So Lundgren started to tell his inner circle that God had identified that the Averys were insufficiently spiritual and they were required as a sacrifice to cleanse the vineyard land before the group would be able to successfully take
the temple. What version of the Bible were these people reading?
Just absolutely made, like written on the back of toilet paper, I imagine, that they're finding, they just will walk out to the forest, find new scripture and return, and it just reinforces their already kind of chaotic beliefs. But an interesting, because he'd already established this idea that the ground had to be cleansed, any, you know, if you propose the idea of mass murder of a family to a follower, they might think that was strange, but it's being positioned as like a roadblock to overcome so that they continue on their mission. And I think that's got to do something with, you know, that's got to affect the psyche of the brain in some way, that he's very astute in how he's telling people this information. So on the evening of the 17th of April, 1989, Lundgren invites the whole family, the Avery family, over to his place for dinner. And one by one, the men, his followers, were leading each member of the Avery family out to the barn where they were bound and shot. Dennis first, then Cheryl, and then the three girls in descending order of age. The youngest was just 6.
Oh.
Horrendous stuff. And there's all these witnesses to it. The other followers are witnessing it. And Lundgren's own son, who was only 18 at the time, was brought in to witness it. And he says that he was physically sick, that it was horrendous. Back in the farmhouse, the rest of the women are just preparing dinner as if nothing had happened. The bodies were then buried under the barn's kind of dirt floor. And before the killings, Lundgren had instructed Cheryl to write to her family to say that they were moving on and would send an address once they had settled. The address obviously never arrived to Cheryl's, the rest of Cheryl's family, but they didn't know where to go looking for her. So there was no report of anything that happened. So no police investigation
going
on here.
And when you got Cheryl to write this letter, did she know we were going to take her into the barn?
I imagine that she knew at that point in time that she was going to be shot.
God.
But an interesting detail here is that the morning after the shootings, the FBI, on another tip, had actually gone to the settlement to check it out because they had heard that the group were hoarding weapons to take over that original temple. So they'd walked around the barn without realising there were 5 bodies freshly buried underneath the dirt and had walked away again. But this kind of spooked Lundgren, so he moved the whole settlement onto new pastures out of Ohio and into a campsite in West Virginia and then onto Missouri. But he would have gotten away with all this typically if it wasn't for a follower, a disillusioned man named Keith Johnson, who'd grown resentful of Lundgren because he had this polygamy. He had a private polygamy pact with the group that he could take as many wives as he wanted. But to get those wives, he was taking them off other men. So Keith Johnson did not like this. And he eventually became so disillusioned and annoyed that 8 months after the murder, he walked into a police station in Kansas, drew a map of the barn and told them what had happened. So Lundgren was caught and executed by lethal injection in 2006. And for the whole time he counted, he never denied what he did, but he kind of justified it in that it was God's command. His wife and his son were spared the death penalty, but both are serving sentences that will essentially keep them in prison for life. The barn was torn down in 2007.
And they built a church on top of it.
They built a church on top. Isn't that kind of crude?
That, yeah.
Yeah.
Who'd go to that church?
Haunted church, I'd imagine.
And it was and it was just the three of them that were prosecuted for
just
this.
Just the three of them prosecuted. I think that, you know, there's more regulations around what has to happen here in terms. But I think people who are often in cults are considered victims unless you're in the top echelons and the elites that make the decisions. But it's usually that you're so bought in and brainwashed by one charismatic leader that you'd lose sight of what everything you believed prior to joining.
Yeah, because I suppose even if you get out of that brainwashing and then you look back afterwards at your own actions,
there's a certain type of person, a susceptibility that I think makes people prime for cults, and the right organizations know exactly who they're going after.
Yeah. Right. Our third story is, this is Quebec. We're going back to Canada anyway.
We're back to Canada and we're with a man called Roch Thirault in the 1950s. Again, another charismatic leader who starts to become, he starts to sort of abuse his own power by essentially thinking he is God and he has all these skills and gifts that he doesn't have. In the 1950s, he leaves school early and taught himself the Old Testament, specifically fixating on the sections about divine punishment. In the 1970s, again, this is a pattern of behavior. He has talked his way into a small following through the Seventh-day Adventist Church, an established church that I think has regulations around mass killings. Not something that often pops up.
As a bare minimum.
They're not going to insist on murder or mass suicide. And he is kind of, he escalates his teachings into these more extremist thoughts. So the church expel him in 1978, but he manages to take a small group of followers with him. So he has the start of a settlement. He renames himself Moses. And again, with this kind of sense of urgency, tells them that the world is going to end in February 1979. Interestingly here, this deadline passes and nothing happens and nobody leaves the organization. Mm-hmm. There's loads of different cults that we see where they often will have a kind of end of world date, and when it doesn't happen, they manage to convince the followers that it didn't happen because they did the work that was required to keep the world alive. But this is an interesting detail because, again, followers here had given up their families, their jobs, and their own names to follow Roch into this new world. And I think it's just like a sunken cost fallacy here. You're like, what am I going to go back to? How do I go back with my tail between my legs and say that big scary cult was a cult? So few people admitted that there was anything wrong here and stuck with him. He manages to move the commune to a remote stretch in the Gas Peninsula that he called Eternal Mountain and later to rural Ontario. So they're moving around all the time. They're alienated from the rest of the world. He fathers 24 children amongst a rotating set of wives and partners, which he described as a religious requirement rather than a personal indulgence. So followers are again forbidden from speaking to each other without permission.
That's so interesting. The same kind of restrictions from one of the previous cases.
Yeah, I mean, it's so easy when you think about it. It's like, I've got all these group of people, only listen to me, don't talk to each other. I'm going to steal all your wives, but God has told me to do this.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
But these things are often positioned as a test from God. And if you buy into the sort of very, the terrifying God of the Old Testament that he was particularly fascinated with, this tracks. This is like, God is something to be feared in those books. But what makes Roch genuinely interesting is that he wasn't just convinced that he was a leader. He also thought that he was a healer and that whatever medical knowledge he required would simply arrive to him sort of by osmosis divinely as he needed it. So when followers fell ill or displeased him, he would just start doing the medicine. He performed surgery with whatever tools he could find in a standard kitchen. When followers tried to leave or anybody angered him in kind of even small ways, they would lose fingers, teeth. In one case, an entire arm was amputated without anesthetic while other members held down the victim. So in 1989, a follower named Solange Bollard complained of stomach pains and Roch decided to operate. Obviously, the procedure killed her within a day. You can't just cut your friends open. That's not allowed. And convinced he could reverse this through the same authority that led him to operate in the first place, he attempted to bring her back to life. Again, that did not work. It was kind of death is very definitive. Her body was buried near the commune and the group continued on as though she had just died of natural causes. But it was the escape of another follower, Gabrielle Lavelle, who fled after Roch had amputated her arm and went to the police. He pleaded guilty to assault over her injuries in 1989 and was sentenced to 12 years. But then a further tip led investigators to Gabrielle's remains and he pleaded guilty again, this time to second degree murder and was sentenced to life. In February 2011, which is interesting in Canada, right? They have this kind of law that if you're in prison, they're not going to add any extra time. If you're in prison for life, you're in prison for life. There's no point in adding extra assault. So if you're in there, you're in there and you kind of whatever you get up to is up to you. So his cellmate at New Brunswick Penitentiary was already serving a life sentence and just stabbed Roch to death and then calmly walked up to the guards, handed over the weapon and told the officers where to go find the body. And he just got away with that kind of scot-free. No additional punishment.
We don't know why he decided to kill Roch.
I imagine
it could have been like, I didn't like him.
Yeah, but I'd also imagine sharing a small room with a fella who thinks he's God,
yeah,
or greater than
that
God.
That might be annoying.
And that, yeah, he, you know, like, very obnoxious to think that he has loads of medical knowledge without going to college for it.
Mm.
I'd imagine he's quite annoying.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to get anything additional onto your sentence, I don't know.
And it's astonishing, again, the people, like, he killed someone by thinking he could perform surgery on them, yeah, but the rest of the group kind of went, ah, well.
Yeah. And at no point, like, he's making these big, mad statements about himself that are proven, disproven a lot of the time. And no one at any point is like, maybe Rock's a liar. You,
yeah,
know, he said the world was going to end and it didn't. He said he could do the surgery and he killed her. At what point, like, how many red flags is it, is enough to get people to see the way?
Right, the final one. This is, there's no killing in this one, thankfully. Though it is bioterrorism at the same time, but it's, for the similar kind of reasons.
It's kind of novel, this one. Yeah. And I think we only ever really hear about the big successful cults where everybody does die. And there's plenty of times where cults have probably started and failed, like many startups,
yeah,
probably last only 3 or 4 months. And this is a story of a cult that just didn't really get the gravitas that, like, any of the other cults before it had. So it's it was in 1981, and an Indian spiritual teacher named Bhagwan Sri Ranjish had moved his followers into Oregon and built this 64,000 acre land commune, like, more or less from nothing. And it essentially was a small city.
Mm, where do these people get the money from to build these massive things?
It's like, I don't know. I have, can hardly make it work in Dublin on my own,
yeah,
let alone giving and paying a tithe over to a cult.
There you go. That's how to solve the housing crisis.
Yeah,
set up a cult.
Get us all together and free bread for all. So he had over 2,500 residents at its peak, and is essentially like a small town. And it would go up to 15,000 people during its annual festival. It had its own sort of police force, its own airstrip, its own fire department. Very self-sufficient in a way. And the Ranjish was actually a decent leader. He had a kind of de facto ruler beside him. His secretary was a woman named Ma Sheila. And Ranjish spent his years being silent and kind of working with the community. He'd taken a vow of sort of servitude to the community and had done quite well. But one thing that was difficult was that the surrounding areas, the surrounding county around the kind of settlement, Wasco County, wanted it to be shut down. They had turned increasingly hostile towards the commune and they were blocking building permits, fighting them through the courts. But the obvious solution here that Sheila kind of came up with was that they would have to win the local elections and take over from within. That if they could infiltrate, get them elected as mayors. And they had done this successfully with a much smaller town. There was a nearby town called Antelope where population was only about 75. But they moved enough followers into the town to outvote everyone who'd already lived there. But the largest town in the county that was causing the most amount of hassle, the Dales, and about 10,000 residents. So they didn't have enough in their 2,500 people settlement to go in and take over effectively. So they tried and failed, a very interesting program where they would bus in thousands of homeless people from across the country under a charitable sounding scheme called Share a Home. It did not work. They did not vote for, they did not kind of get behind Ranjish, and it became clear that it wasn't going to work. So when that, basically the town was like, we're not going to let these people vote and register to vote, yeah, in time to take over. We kind of see what you're doing. It's quite obvious. So when this plan failed, they decided to come up with an alternative plan, which was that if they can't go in and outnumber the voters who were there, maybe they could make the voters who were there sick enough that they can't make it out on the day to vote. So they started manufacturing salmonella and they took in a lab, a lab manufactured salmonella bacteria, and under the supervision of a nurse known to the group as Ma Pooja, they had sort of like mass manufacturing salmonella, and they were putting it everywhere around the town. They were going in, they put it in their water supply, they put it in restaurants, and particularly in salad bars.
Okay.
All over the place. So 751 people got food poisoning, 45 were hospitalized. An investigator spent the better part of a year genuinely stumped as to where the salmonella was coming from. Kitchens were obviously checked and signed off, and they could not understand what was behind this, essentially America's largest act of bioterrorism to ever have existed. So the plan even got stranger. They were poisoning people who were coming into the commune to visit as kind of just maybe for a bit of whimsy. There was a serious internal discussion of introducing the bacteria directly into the public water supply. But I think this became just too big a job to hand off. But in the end, none of it worked. It could not swing the election. Every candidate in the commune backed lost regardless. And the entire operation came to light a year later when, again, internal defectors went to the FBI and started ratting on the guys who were making the salmonella back at the commune.
That's extraordinary. That's extraordinary. And did he get prison for this, or what did they do to him?
He did. They got convicted in the end. It was the largest bioterrorism attack in American history. So he was convicted and served time for the poisonings. Nobody died, but all his collection of Rolls Royces were sold off.
How many did he have?
He had nine.
There you go. Religion pays. Cassie, thanks a million.
Thank you as ever.
Cassie Delaney there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.